The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week,
we were moving at a very fast pace, and I think sometimes when you move at a fast pace, it's important to take a moment and see exactly where you are and take really a good hard look at the technology.
Ewan Ashley from Stanford University discusses the rapid developments in genomics and why improved technologies and falling costs may have blindsided us into thinking reading our genomes is the answer to every ill. Also on the show, we'll be discussing some of this week's top science news stories, including the role of exoskeleton robotics at the opening of this year's World Cup in Brazil, why the UK revisited its Dickensian past with an official smog alert, and the future of the electronic nose. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Back in the pod today are Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of the award-winning Observer Tech Monthly, and The Guardian's environment web editor, Adam Vaughan. Welcome both.
Hello.
Adam, let's kick off with you. The environment desk was kept busy over the past few days due to a strange form of smog. Tell us more.
Don't breathe. That's my advice. Although I did go for a run at the height of it all, which, according to one of the public health experts who's talking about it, is sheer stupidity. So I did exactly what you weren't meant to be doing, being an asthmatic. It's foreign sand is to blame. So UKIP, I'm sure, will be making great hay out of this. We've had extremely high, or very high in the official scale, air pollution in the last few days across England and Wales, most of England actually, on Wednesday. The funny thing about this is this has become front page news, but bizarrely we had an episode not that dissimilar about 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was exactly the same sort of level. So that's the story here really, is that we've suddenly woken up to the fact that actually our air is not very clean. This is not really news. I mean, it's been compounded by this unusual and exotic edition of Saharan dust, which there are some amazing satellite photographs of it, almost kind of like comical, kind of like straight line going from the desert up to Northern Europe. So that has made it worse and has given some newspapers opportunities to offer free car washes for those people, because the real story here is dust on cars, obviously, not people's health.
What is the source of this pollution, though? Why is the pollution building up? Because the Saharan dust is an element, but it's been a bit overblown about how much of an aspect of it that is. What about the actual pollution of things like, you know, the PM2.5s and things like that that are building up?
So, yeah, the Saharan dust element, I mean, Cameron is sort of, you know, trying to play it as, you know, it's a naturally occurring weather phenomenon, don't worry, you know, that this happens from time to time. But what we are looking at here is, you know, there are five main pollutants. There's nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, what else we've got, ozone, and two types of particulate matter, PM10s and PM2.5s, which are the smaller they get, the 2.5s, how many microns across they are, and the smaller the worse in terms of the further it can get into your body, as it were. So those are the groups that we've got, and nitrogen dioxide is, funnily enough, actually the one we have a real problem with in the UK. It's the one that we're in breach of our European legal limits on, and it's the thing that we're facing fines of hundreds of thousands of pounds from Europe because we've been in breach of it for years. And rather than actually doing something about it, actually the government spent most of its time lobbying to fight off the threat of those fines. It spent most, rather than tackling this, which, to be honest, is, I mean, the government, I don't know, you know, don't want to go on a complete rant here, but the government has been very complacent about this, and it has been, and a sort of local level with Boris Johnson and a national level, has sort of tended to tackle this thing in terms of symptoms rather than Boris's approach has been to try and glue pollution to roads, which experts say failed, rather than actually acknowledging maybe it's coming from diesel cars, which, you know, so nitrogen dioxide. Interesting. There's a recent, the timing was quite interesting of diesel car sales. We've seen now more people own diesel cars in the UK than petrol. And obviously, we were just thinking, oh, they're just a weird thing for Europeans. But now we have started to buy diesel cars in much greater numbers. And ironically, some of the sort of climate change policies that we have in place, again, at both a national and local level, have have encouraged those, because vehicle excise duty, otherwise known as road tax, encourages you to buy a car with low carbon emissions. And that tends to be, it's a very easy to make a relatively cheap diesel car with low carbon emissions than it is a petrol one, which tend to need like a hybrid technology to bring it down. And also, for example, in London, you know, Boris has been encouraging diesel cars get in for free and the congestion charge if they're, sorry, low CO2 cars get in for free. And a lot of the newer diesels happen to be good for climate change, but bad
for air pollution. But those diesels are producing the particulates.
Yeah, they're responsible for particulate matter and for the nitrogen dioxide. So yeah, and I mean, and the other thing is as well is, you know, you can't solely squarely lay the blame just on the UK. You know, it's not just the UK. A lot of this, you know, there is still a lot of industry in Europe, in parts of Northern Europe, and as we've seen with previous episodes, it comes over the channel, it gets blown over. You know, so this is where you get your sulfur dioxide and the other problems. So you know, it's not all of our own making, but you know, and we have industry in this country as well, so obviously still.
I think one of the researchers at Reading University called it a perfect storm, because you had our self-created pollution, weather conditions here that allowed that to kind of linger around. The gentle winds that were coming in were easterlies bringing polluted air off the continent, and then you had the Saharan dust for that little bit of exotic element that all the media went crazy for as well.
I mean, to be fair, he's right, right? You know, but I suppose the thing would say we can't do much about the Sahara. I think unless we dig it up or something, we can't do much about which way the wind blows. But we can do something about our industry and our transport.
Nicola.
Okay. Well, one of the questions I was going to ask. Was whether things like face masks, I mean, do they do any good? We see people wandering around with that sort of thing on. We see cyclists with them on. Is that all a bit of a sort of a completely useless waste of time, or does it make a difference?
I haven't interrogated the sort of face masks on sale in the UK, but certainly a lot that you see in the photos of Beijing, the sort of the very typical little white face mask, I mean, they're not going to protect you from these tiny particulates, because they'll just go straight through it. I mean, these things are, you know, the smallest ones are 2.5 microns across. A little paper mask isn't going to stop that. I think if you genuinely wanted to avoid any of the ill effects of it, you'd need like a sort of industrial level respirator. You know, I think the reality is, especially if you look at the price, I mean, certainly in the UK, the price I've seen some of the face masks for, I very much doubt they're going to protect you. I think the reality, this is the thing that's interesting about it. You know, it affects everyone, right? Every class, it doesn't matter where, you know, by and large, because it's been so widespread, it affects everyone, you know. You can stay, I mean, the official health advice has been to stay indoors. I mean, okay, so can you imagine the conversation with your boss? I'm not coming because the air's dirty today, you know, it's... What are you going to do?
And has there been a rise in hospital admissions or anything based on this?
So it's too early to say whether there's been a rise in hospital admissions, but looking at past previous pollution episodes, we can pretty much guess there is going to be one this time around, considering the severity of it. We do know that the London Ambulance Service has already reported an increase in number of people phoning in with breathing problems.
Thanks, Adam. And remember, for up-to-the-minute environment news day or night, just go to theguardian.com/environment. I wrote a piece last week about cutting-edge robotics that's going to make the opening ceremony of this summer's World Cup in Brazil even more exciting, if that's at all possible. The work involved was what I liked about it. It's a mind-controlled exoskeleton for a paraplegic. And the idea is that you'll have someone who is disabled, who can't feel their legs or move their legs at all because of a spinal injury, who will be on the pitch at the opening ceremony. They'll be on the ground of the opening ceremony in the arena where they're going to have the first game on the 12th of June. And they'll use this exoskeleton through their thoughts to stand up and then walk over to the ball and take a kick as a kind of demonstration of this whole technology. And it'll use a kind of cap which has electrodes in it to read off the EEG signals from the patient's brain. And the exoskeleton was built by some French researchers and is now in Brazil, where they're training up 9 patients to try and use this device. And it's kind of interesting because I think it's the start of... A lot of exoskeleton work has been done, but it feels like this is a real attempt to try and get this technology into everyday patients, if you like. And the idea being that instead of having to use wheelchairs or using wheelchairs, then that people might be able to use something that I don't know if it's going to give them much more freedom, but it'll certainly be sort of a bit more natural. And one of the quite cute things about it is it has some sensors in the feet and elsewhere on the exoskeleton that they call artificial skin, but which is a bit of a stretch perhaps because they're really sort of sensors that just check when you touch the ground. And you can send a signal up to a device in the shirt that you wear, which just makes a little vibration sensation on your skin. But the way your brain interprets it, at least in the virtual reality tests they've done so far, is because you know your legs are being moved and you know when they're, you see when they're contacting the floor, this sensation that you feel from this device is actually interpreted by your brain as your feet touching the floor. And some of the patients say, oh, it feels like my legs are moving. And it's a really strange thing about how your body kind of perceives itself and creates an image of itself from these various, it's trying to make sense of the inputs it's getting. So that I had a bit of fun writing about that, and we'll see what happens in the opening ceremony of the World Cup.
I have a question about this. How much do you have to concentrate on moving your feet? I mean, if you suddenly saw something interesting yonder to the side and you stopped thinking about moving your feet, like consciously, I mean like focusedly, then would that mean you wouldn't be moving anywhere?
Well, I think a lot of it, the researcher Miguel Nicolelis, who's normally based at Duke University in North Carolina, is being very cagey at the moment about what brain signals he's picking up to do what. But my sense of it is that you're, like when you walk, you don't think left foot, right foot, and bend my leg. And, you know, it's not a sort of that kind of process. It's very much an automatic process. And I think what they'll be doing is trying to pick up a signal that is a fairly general brain activity that is there when you are when you want to walk and not there when you don't want to walk. So almost like a start stop.
I guess the thing is, like, how well will it be able to differentiate or pick that signal out from all the other noise that's going on in one's mind?
I think that's going to be the real trick, and that's what they've been doing in terms of they've been getting people to watch video of people walking and looking at their brain activity while they're watching walking. So you almost get like a brain activity from that's what walking looks like, and then okay, think about walking, think about moving, what brain activities does that create? And the trick in this is all going to be about the point you're talking about, is getting out a signal that's reliable, because you don't want a sort of situation, you know, a sort of a Wallace and Gromit's wrong trousers situation coming off where this suit suddenly just starts stomping off into the distance with your sort of hapless paraplegic sort of trapped inside. And so it's this is all due to come out in research papers that are ongoing, and I think it's going to be that's going to be an interesting one. One of the things they did have to do was visit football matches with the equipment to make sure that mobile phone interference didn't set it off and interfere just by raising the level of noise. So you have the noise in the brain already just from people thinking about different stuff. And Lord only knows what happens if you're thinking about walking while watching a football match, where you're watching a lot of people who are, you know, sort of 20 out of 22 are sort of walking around. And that was really interesting, because they have to make sure that just the background electromagnetic interference sort of threat, if you like, inside the stadium isn't going to just swamp any signals they're picking up.
I love this, because it's just just watching the video, it's just a fast sort of four bit of engineering. The actual suit is kind of amazing. But I also wonder, because we've seen like various other sort of exoskeletons and robotic limbs and stuff that use some sort of mind control. I wondered, is this substantially different in terms of the technology and the approach it's taking? Or
I think what's going to be, I think actually that this differs in a number of ways, and it's very much a demo, and it's being done as, I think they have to kind of simplify with this, really. Because if you look at some of the lab stuff that this guy has done, he's had patients and primates with implanted electrodes moving robotic arms in and picking things up, and so doing quite sophisticated movements and with different degrees of freedom. This is a suit that will allow you to stand up and walk and turn and things like that, and the actual control of that, I think, is going to be probably more simple actually than some of the stuff he's done in the lab, but they have to make sure it's really reliable.
So I was going to say, what's also exciting is that, sort of related to this story, is that as yesterday we noted in Tech Monthly, we had a very short piece about the Cybathlon, which has been announced, which will be taking place in October 2016 in Zurich, where they're hoping to encourage robotics groups and technologists to create new devices for a variety of paraplegic participants. And they're going to have brain-computer interface races, powered exoskeleton races, powered wheelchair races, arm prosthetics races. And they were unlike the Olympics and Paralympics, where you have very clear, sort of, you know, everyone has to have the same equipment to make everything. This is going to be about pushing technology and seeing what you can do. So it looks like it's the beginning of a new era.
It's like some exciting. Of these DARPA challenges, you know, the US Pentagon research outfit, where they have challenges to try and get, you know, robots to perform certain tasks. And the whole idea is just to make this an open market, open competition, and see what technologies work, I suppose, by getting everyone from universities to garage engineers to come up with their best efforts.
It's obviously early doors, but I mean, you talk about wheelchairs. I mean, is this the wheelchair of the future? You know,
future. His stated aim is to make wheelchairs obsolete, which, you know, sounds absolutely laudable. But you think, okay, so you're going to go for like this sort of bipedal machine that you have to go inside, really, and it's a serious piece of kit. It's not going to be cheap. You know, it has the battery life they have at the moment. The battery goes in a pretty big rucksack with the sort of hydraulic systems inside there that then drive the thing. The battery gives you 2 hours of activity at the moment, and you don't really want to get to the shops with your newspaper and then be stranded there.
It's funny, isn't it? The batteries is one of the things that's holding it back. It's like it's the same across so many areas of technology, from you know, small consumer electronics to you know, electric cars, for example. There's a real lack of, you know, increasing appetite, isn't there, for a breakthrough there?
Think what you, and also you want this thing to be quiet as well, so you don't want to have a, you know, you don't have a massive petrol engine on the back there, like, look like, you know, I mean, you have to sort of think, what are you actually replacing a wheelchair with? It has to be something that's far more acceptable. And, you know, can this thing, at the moment, this won't go upstairs, you know? And so I know that's a problem with wheelchairs as well, but, you know, it's early days. To watch a video of the exoskeleton in action, just go to theguardian.com/science. Nicola, you had an intriguing story in Observer Tech Monthly yesterday about merging off factory sensors with electronics. Take us through that one.
Well, I spoke to Dr. James Covington from the University of Warwick to tell me a bit about a new sort of diagnostic tool, which is very promising. It's the electronic nose, which sounds more comedic than it actually is. It's not literally nose-shaped or in any way looks like a human nose, but the job it does is in some way similar, and that's the important thing. So when we smell something, if you have a strawberry, you'll take a whiff of this strawberry and you'll say, ah, it's a strawberry. But you don't think about the exact chemicals that make up that scent. It's the overall smell that you recognise as being a strawberry. And that's what they're trying to do with this technology. They're trying to get machines to recognise a pattern that is that is linked to a particular disease. So what would happen then is you'd be able to breathe into this device and it will be able to pick up scents on your odours on your breath, which are indicative of certain diseases. So that's the aim of the technology. And it's sort of similar. I mean, you know, you might have seen things like, you know, dogs sniffing out cancers. It's the same sort of idea that certain diseases produce certain chemicals which give rise to certain odours which we can pick up.
Given our noses can do that already, begs the question, why? Why? Not just because they could.
Well, you need something that's very sensitive. So a dog is a very, very, very sensitive olfactory system. So that's why dogs particularly get this. I think there's a company called, I can't remember its name, but it uses bees. It's trying to train bees to detect certain smells. Same kind of technology that they use to sniff out explosives. It's all the same sort of idea about being able to detect.
So is that
chemicals.
Sort of applications we're talking about here?
Well, mainly this particular piece is all about it in relation to healthcare. So about being able to detect diseases. And so there are certain diseases, for example, if there isn't a diagnosis that's particularly, a diagnostic method that's particularly cheap, that could be a place where this could be useful. Or if it's very invasive type of testing that they typically do, that could also be where this could come in useful because it's very non-invasive. So these kind of areas are
You've
important.
Lost me. It can smell diseases. I don't know.
Yeah. So for example, there are some diseases which the current screening methods are quite invasive or are unpleasant. So one of the examples, as Dr. Covington was talking to me about, was colorectal cancer, where the tests are only 40% accurate. People have to give a stool sample. People get really upset about doing that. It's not something people... It's not, people are very uncomfortable about that. If you could use an electronic nose to maybe even detect odors coming off a urine sample rather than having to do stool sample, that might be something where people feel more comfortable. And so it's good in those kind of areas. And I think also it's currently showing promise for TB as well. So you can detect TB on the breath with these kind of instruments. So, for example, also in developing countries where you don't have maybe the facilities to do some of the more advanced screening and testing processes, that could also be useful there.
How do you go through and sort of verify all this kind of stuff? Because presumably what you need to do is get a whole load of people that you know don't have a particular condition, and then a load of people that you know have that condition but at a pretty early stage, I imagine, and then compare the kind of signatures, the smell signatures you're getting off both groups with enough and have enough. No, you can do that reliably enough to use this as a test, but you need to make sure sort of, you need to know that your group without the disease really don't have it, or anything that mimics it, or anything that will swamp the signal. And it just sounds quite...
It's not the kind of thing that is sort of just launched on the market sort of willy-nilly. It's something that does need a lot of care. But there are commercialised products already, but they've sort of been fairly recent in coming on the market. But the research has been around for a while. As Dr. Covington was telling me, you know, the potential has been known for some time, but the technology is now catching up. Mm. And that's the important point. And, you know, in the future, we could have things. I mean, it might be possible to have sort of devices you can plug into your mobile phone. You can do, you know, home diagnostic type things. There's huge potential for this area.
No, it's really banal, my question, actually. But just given the name of nose, is it nose sized? Is it the size of a laptop? I want to know how big the machine is.
They're portable. These are not huge, chunky. They're portable, but they're certainly not nose sized.
You can see this being taken up by the whole group of people who are into this sort of self quantification idea, especially if you get this to be some kind of app on a mobile device at some stage. Because what you can do is, what you could do presumably is have the system could know what your breath or what have you normally smells like, and then you look for interesting deviations from that. And it's kind of one of the things that they've looked at doing with drug testing for athletes. And so you know an athlete's typical, say, hormonal profile or a profile of other sort of blood metabolites and things like that. And then what you're doing is you're looking for changes. So you don't actually need to know the next drug that comes along. You just have to know that something has changed radically in this person that is going to make them sort of behave or be able to compete differently. If you can look for those kinds of things with an artificial nose, maybe looking at different compounds coming out of your breath and so on, then suddenly get a big anomaly of a certain substance.
Sure.
Substance.
It's not just about diagnosing, it's about monitoring health as well. Wow. And that's another exciting application.
I look forward to seeing it.
I didn't know you were a quantified self geek, Ian.
I'm not.
You just measure.
Do I look like I keep daily tabs on my well-being?
A pedometer and a sleep sensor.
Go to bed with a lamp on my head just to monitor the lack of sleep I get. Nicola, I can't let you go without you telling me about the Observer Tech Monthly prizes. Let's bask a little.
Yes, well, we did quite well actually on Tech Monthly. So congratulations to the whole team and everyone who pitches in and does so much on the supplement. It's been a really fantastic time that we've had. So we were won the highly commended in the supplement of the year from the Press Awards, and we got two awards from the Newspaper Awards this year as well, which was the Colour Supplement of the Year and also the Best of the Best Award as well. So we're very chuffed.
Get you. Well done. Thank you, Nicola. Thanks, Adam. And if you missed yesterday's brilliant Observer Tech Monthly, you can check it all out at the Guardian website. The increasing power of computing has advanced every area of science, but when it comes to genetics, computers have transformed a time-consuming and expensive process into a relatively cheap and accessible set of diagnostic tools. The rapid adoption of these tools has led to the promise of a new era in personal genomics and created a commonly held expectation that mapping our genes will help us cure all ills. Ewan Ashley is at the forefront of this science in his role as Director of Clinical Genomic Services at Stanford University Medical Center in California, and well-placed to survey the huge progress made in the area. And that's what he and his team set out to do, to deflate the hype and outline the real value of gene testing and why some sobriety in the research community and beyond is needed if personal genomics is to become part of everyday medicine. I spoke to Ewan from Stanford and started by asking him to outline the dizzying speed of progress in the field.
So back in 2009, we had the realization that the amazing transformation in technology for sequencing, that is, spelling out the different letters of the human genome, was leading to a massive reduction in cost that really had outstripped anything that we had witnessed before in the technology space in this area. In particular, the Human Genome Project that took around 10 years was funded at $3 billion. But over the course of the years following that, that price dropped first of all into the millions and then into the tens of thousands, and most recently under $10,000 around the time that we were doing the study. 2009, we realized perhaps for the first time that patients were soon going to walk into our clinic with their genomes and that we needed to be ready and that we weren't ready. So we gathered together a team from Stanford and others and thought about how we might go about interpreting a human genome. And that study was published in The Lancet in 2010 and led to a great deal of interest. And since then, the idea of genome sequencing, or perhaps more commonly something called exome sequencing, which is sequencing the 2% of the genome that makes up the genes, the proteins that do the work of the cell, that has become not yet common, but that has started to reach into medicine and started to make a difference in people's lives. And so we were interested in this new study to really take a good hard look at the technology, where it was today, and compare it to where we were in the past to look at the opportunities and challenges that would move us forward.
I mean, there's an awful lot of hope around this this kind of technology, the idea that, you know, children will be have their whole genome sequenced at birth, and then from evermore it will be on their medical records and their treatments can be personalised all the way through. And obviously a lot of companies are trying to make money out of selling these sort of kits and doing analyses or at least doing the reading of patients. But what did you actually set out to try and do with this latest study? What were you trying to get at?
Well, the thinking was that as the technology has reached into clinical care, that we were moving at a very fast pace. And I think sometimes when you move at a fast pace, it's important to take a moment and see exactly where you are and take really a good hard look at the technology. So we took 12 individuals who were patients that attended Stanford Hospital, and we decided to sequence their entire genomes on two different platforms. So that's two different approaches to sequencing their genomes. And then do an absolutely full analysis. So the equivalent of what we did once in 2010, we did for each one of these individuals, essentially twice, in order to compare what we get from a technological standpoint from both, but also to think about what the opportunity was, in other words, what we found that might be relevant for their health and future disease risk, but also importantly, what is the burden? So what does this cost in terms of money? What does it cost in terms of time? And what sort of a team do you need to put together in order to be able to analyze genomes within the medical system?
And so how does this technology come out? What is your take on it after giving this kind of snapshot of where you're at with it?
Well, I think the most important thing was that we found that there was significant opportunity. In one individual, for example, within the study, we found a genetic variant that was previously unknown to the individual that caused significant risk for breast and ovarian cancer. And we were able to return that result to the individual, and she was able to go off and take action to prevent the risk of further disease. And so I think that speaks to the incredible opportunity. In every individual, we found one variant that was potentially relevant for future prescribing, the idea of pharmacogenomics, where your genome can help your doctor essentially choose the right drugs for you, a case of personalized medicine. But then on the challenge side, we realized that although this technology is exciting and cheap, for example, at the moment we send genetic tests of a few genes, maybe 5 to 15 genes, and it takes several months and costs several thousand dollars. Now we can send a whole genome that takes just a few days and costs only a few thousand dollars. And so that really is a mind-blowing change in the technology for sequencing. But the question is, have we lost something in quality along the way? And I think part of the result that we have here is that, yes, indeed, We have to pay a bit more attention to bring the new technology up to the quality of the old technology for genome sequencing. And a specific example of that is comparing the two platforms. We sequenced using two completely different technologies in this study. And a particular kind of variation where one letter is substituted for another, we were pretty good at that, 99% agreement between the two technologies. But there's another kind of variation that is particularly important for disease risk, where a word is kind of inserted or deleted from a genome. And we found that the two technologies agreed only 55% of the time, so only around half the time, which really isn't clearly at the standard that we would need it to be for clinical medicine if we're going to be making clinical decisions and decisions that affect people's lives on the basis of the calls that are made by these technologies.
You also found quite a lot of difference in the time it took to do the kind of assessment of the actual interpretation of what any single individual's genome really meant.
Yeah, so I think that's a really important point. We've talked about how the $1,000 genome was coming, but that the interpretation would be $1 million. And while it's certainly not $1 million, this is really the first study to measure how long it would take to do a full interpretation, sort of within the clinic setting. And I think those of us who've been doing this for some time were actually surprised in a positive direction by this. You start off when you run a genome, you end up with about 3.5 million variants. So that's areas where one individual's genome is different from the reference sequence. And so we start with 3.5 million and then apply a bunch of computer algorithms and filters to bring that down. And it brought it down to around 100 variants per individual that we felt needed really intensive look to see if that they were important. But each of those variants takes about an hour in order to really pull the evidence together from a variety of sources, from the literature, from databases, to really decide if that variant is important or not. And at the end of that process, we found between 2 and 6 variants per individual that were really important enough to put on a report and discuss with them.
Can you put all this together and come up with an overall cost, either in money or time, that it actually takes to genuinely do someone's genome and then have an interpretation that actually means anything?
Yeah, I think so. That was really one of the principal aims of the study. And we carried out the sequencing for the study about a year ago when the clinical standard genome cost $10,000. And the interpretation, we estimated that 100 hours, about $50 an hour of curation. We came up with a number around $16,000 to do this. And of course, that has price has dropped already. One of the dizzying things here is just how fast the technology moves forward. And so we reckon that the sequencing is now about half that. The clinical price for a genome today is around $4,000 or $5,000. And so $5,000 then for the interpretation is about $10,000 or about £6,000.
This point you raised earlier, though, is a serious problem where you have two different technologies and they only agree half the time on when you have certain types of genetic defects going on. What can be done about that? What has to be done about that?
Yeah, so we think this is a pretty urgent area of need within the community. We all really have to work together to improve this. It is a tricky challenge because you have one gene from your mom and one gene from your dad, and so there are really two messages in any genome, and they have to be resolved, and if they're different, it can be tricky. But really part of our message here is that we do think these are solvable problems. We just need the community to really pay attention and for us all to come together and think of better algorithms, better filters, better ways of discerning these two messages so that we can do this more accurately.
But this sort of lack of accuracy issue that is one of the aspects of your paper, I mean, is that something that's just people have been unaware of? Has it been sort of brushed under the carpet in the sort of rush to try and make money out of this stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if it's necessarily to make money, but it's certainly, I think, it hasn't received as much attention as it might do, I think, in people's enthusiasm. With new technologies, especially those technologies that could be as transformative as genome sequencing could be, I think there's certainly a rush of excitement, and you know, we were part of that kicking this off in 2009-2010. But I think that also, I mean, we think of ourselves as perhaps we were witness to the birth of this idea of applying genome sequencing to medicine, but that what we have on our hands now is a kind of unruly teenager that's in need of some tough love in order to really turn it into an A-class citizen adult. I mean, I think that that's partly what we're saying with the paper, that we haven't paid enough attention to these potential areas of concern, and that we need to pay more attention in order to bring the technology up to really the standard that's required for clinical medicine.
What are the consequences for patients of this?
Well, I think that what it means is that things that we know what we know. So there are certain areas where we can be really quite confident with this technology alone when we find something, and that can be transformative, and there's lots of examples of that over the past year or two, where a true finding from this kind of technology has really changed people's lives. I think there are other areas, and we think our paper can help in this way, to point out where we have less confidence or where we need to be suspicious and potentially use another technology to double-check before we return these findings to patients.
What do you think it means for direct-to-consumer gene testing? A lot of popularity around those at the moment.
Yeah, so the direct-to-consumer market has in particular focused on gene chips. So that's a little bit like looking at the first letter of every word in a book, as opposed to what we're doing here, which is sequencing, which is really to look at every single letter and every single word. For the most part, those technologies in the direct-to-consumer space have looked at common variants. So those are variants that we now understand are very confidently associated with disease, but they're associated really with very small effects. And so it's important to put that in perspective, that while there is a medical relevance to that, at the moment its place is a lot less clear, whereas gene sequencing and increasingly now genome sequencing is something that's been part of the medical approach to genetic disease for many, many years.
You're in the conflicts of interest in the paper here. A lot of the authors on this paper all have either stocks in genetic analysis companies, or they are founders. I know you yourself are a founder of a company that does interpretation of genetic sequencing and so on. So I'm wondering if there'll be people there who say, well, you know, it's kind of in your interest to say that there are problems with genetic analyses as done at the moment.
Well, no, I think that's also a legitimate question. And one of the important things about the transparency with the papers is that everyone puts out the various relationships that they have, and that the readers get to decide where they think the motivations lie. I mean, in our case, we're all either practicing geneticists or practicing physicians or practicing scientists as our main job. We understand there are some things that can be done in a very effectively within an academic setting, and some things are more effectively done within an industry setting. But I think the clear message with this paper is to celebrate the opportunity provided by genome sequencing, but also to be just very realistic about what the challenges are. And I mean, are those of us who advise this very large number of companies in this space, are we telling these companies that there are areas of challenge for us all to improve the technology? We're certainly telling them that. I don't think there's any sense in which one company over another would benefit. Our idea is really for all the boats to rise here so that we can really have this technology fulfill its potential.
But do you think that this area has been sort of hyped to produce a fairly unrealistic view of how genomics might help people in the future? Maybe, and I certainly would include the media as having a role in that, but if that is the case, if you think maybe the sort of perception of how useful this will be has got ahead of the reality, what do you see as the real situation? What do you think, how do you think this information will be useful in the next 5-10 years and such like?
Well, I think with any new technology, there is some inevitable celebration, and that leads to hype. And I think in particular, the reduction in cost that we've seen with genome sequencing technology really outstrips anything I've seen in any sphere of science or medicine, certainly in my lifetime. And I think that's where the excitement comes from, and that can obviously, the danger there is that we promise too much and then deliver too little. But I think that we can make an argument that already this technology is beginning to deliver. I think that the important thing is that we mustn't rush to thinking that everybody's going to have a genome in their medical record and this is going to happen tomorrow. That was part of the vision that we put forward when we did this for the first time in 2009. But we, more than anyone, I think, appreciate that you have to do one before you can do two, and that there's an incremental basis to this. And so I think, you know, there are areas, for example, in mystery diseases, kids whose diagnosis has evaded all of current technologies, who now have a clear understanding, or their family has a clear understanding of what causes their disease. In some cases, there is an understanding of how to treat it better. We had a recent case of a baby in the neonatal intensive care unit that presented with long QT syndrome, which is a syndrome that can be associated with sudden death, and it's defined by its genetic basis. And so if you know which gene causes the disease in that case, you can alter your management and make it more effective. Now, in the past, that would take 4 months, and you'd be able to look at 5 genes. But within the course of 3 days, we were able to return the whole genome and identify the variant that caused the disease and hand that back to the physicians looking after the baby. So I think that there's no question that the technology is already beginning to transform how we do medicine. But I think that equally, we need to be very realistic. If we sort of love this technology so much, we need to be very realistic about what it can do today and what we need to continue to work on to have it really fulfill its potential.
Just finally, what is the right way to go with the issue of finding something in someone's genetic makeup that can't be treated, that there is nothing that can be done about it? What is the right way forward with that, or is that still really being wrestled with?
No, that's a really important point, and I think that this is something that we've been aware of for the last few years, and we've built structure around our databases of genetic variants specifically to deal with that. So, for example, if you present with a heart condition and your genome is sequenced to try to find the cause of that heart condition, then of course you get all the heart genes back, but you also get the genes that are associated with Alzheimer's disease or with breast and ovarian cancer risk. And the question is, in some of those situations, for most people, if there's an easy intervention, something that can avert disease, then I think everybody would choose to know that. But there are conditions, as you mentioned, for which we don't have good treatment right now. And I think what we need to do is empower the patients and make sure that if they're going to have this done, that they get a choice as to what they want to hear back. And I think we can do that by giving broad classifications of the sorts of variants that they would want to know about, and that we can use our filters in order to just deliver back the information that they want to know.
And is that, again, something that really feeds into this issue of the direct-to-consumer testing, where the counselling is enormously important?
That's absolutely correct. And that's something that we've done from the beginning, is include genetic counsellors and ethicists in our team here at Stanford. And I think before anyone has their genome sequence, they have a full counselling session to talk about the sorts of things they might find out and what they wanted to know. And then, of course, the return of results is done by a genetic counsellor who talks through the individual variants and is present there for the patient. I think you're right, again, with the direct-to-consumer, that's a piece that is less personal and that is missing in the traditional sense. But the companies do provide some degree of information on the website and even some videos to help people understand before they unlock certain results from their sequencing or from their gene chip results that relate to disease. And so I think that there are new ways of doing that, and I think we're in a new world as far as this technology is concerned.
It must be quite interesting for people with your sort of expertise, because I wonder if you've had your own genome sequence fully, and if so, whether you averted your eyes from any areas.
Yeah, so I have had my genome sequence, and I decided that I wanted to know everything. And I think that, you know, I live in a world where we deal with this every day. I see patients every week and deal with genetic test results. And I think the important thing to remember about the genes and the variants that we have in our genes is that they affect your probability of getting disease for the most part. They aren't what we would call deterministic. That means that it's unlikely that we'll find too many variants that say for sure you will get this disease. For the most part, maybe your risk starts at 10%, or maybe your genome can push it a little bit in either direction.
A huge thanks to Ewan Ashley there. We'll have links to Ewan's work on the blog for this podcast. That's all we have for you this week. So from me, Ian Sample, Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, and all the Science team, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.